Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
I think what all of us really want to do when you have an independent, smaller restaurant, even our restaurant seats 400 people, where you can trust the person that is raising your beef and processing your beef.
Greg Rago of Nick's English Hut talking about his relationship with farmer Dave Fisher. We hear how relationships are the key to getting local food onto local menus. It's been oh so very rainy this summer. Harvest Public Media says this could be a sign of the future for the Midwest. Researchers are constructing apartment complexes for bees, and Chef Arlen Llewellyn is making some vegetarian tacos for us today featuring local cabbage and eggplant. Luann Johnson is on vacation this week, so I'm glad to welcome in Mark Chilla to read our headlines from the world of food and agriculture.
Three stories for you today, Annie. Dairy farmers in New England are dumping milk as saturated processing plants fail to keep up with record production. For the fifth year in a row, U.S. milk production has reached record levels. According to Bloomberg, the glut has caused dairy producers to pour milk into dirt holes. Government data shows that dairies in the Northeast have dumped 31% more this year than over the same period last year. Increased production is attributed in part to cheaper and more plentiful feed for cows. A USDA report from 2013 said Americans drink 37% less milk today than they did in 1970, though booming cheese production is driving global milk demand, which is expected to rise for a sixth straight year. Researchers at the John B. Pierce Laboratory and the Yale School of Medicine have found people who can vividly imagine smells of foods are at a greater risk of obesity. Subjects filled out questionnaires about imagining smells, both food and non-food, and researchers compared their body masses. Those with a greater imaginative sense of smell for both food and non-food items had a higher body mass index. And a new report from food industry watchdogs outlines shady communication strategies from food and agriculture industry groups to counteract increasing concern about the industrial food system. The report from Real Food Media Project, Friends of the Earth, and U.S. Right to Know tracks the efforts of companies like Monsanto, Dow Chemical, and DuPont, which spends millions of dollars to create front groups that woo food bloggers, attack critical journalists, spread industry messages over social media, and place advertorials that are often poorly labeled. The report includes profiles of 14 front groups with industry funding such as the U.S. Farmers and Ranchers Alliance, the Alliance for Food and Farming, and the Center for Food Integrity that spent $125 million from 2009 to 2011 to push industry messages. Anna LePay is the founder of the Real Food Media Project and a co-author of the study.
I think that as more people learn about these kinds of tactics that the food industry uses and how much misinformation is out there, I hope that that really helps inspire people to really absorb the media that they hear both in traditional media as well as on social media, absorb it with a more critical eye.
Groups mentioned in the report were quick to push back against the findings, saying the authors unfairly use loaded words like propaganda and spin to describe their public relations campaigns. The Alliance for Food and Farming said groups like Friends of the Earth are well-funded and biased against conventional farming. These stories are posted at eartheats.org.
Twitter, of course, is where we post news articles like these all week. Find us at EarthEats. Mark Chilla, thanks for stepping in.
My pleasure.
Heavy rains battered the Midwest this spring, flooding fields and drowning crops. But big storms this year are not just bad luck. As Harvest Public Media's Abby Wendell reports, more violent spring and summertime storms could be the new normal.
The Midwest is sopping wet. Illinois had its rainiest June on record. Rivers in Iowa could crest higher than ever. Many are jumping their banks. And Missouri is struggling to soak up 150% more moisture than it's used to getting in the spring. The corn crop is in trouble, and many farmers haven't been able to get their soybeans in the ground. Farmers like Matt Plenge. He usually farms 5,000 acres of corn and soybeans in northeastern Missouri. But when he walks out into his fields that should be filled with a new crop, it sounds like this. Plunge roots around in the muck and pulls up a pale and puffy soybean seedling with a broken stem.
See how that's rotted right there? Whenever they lay in water, or they might sprout, and then they'll just instantly kind of turn brown and just rot right there in the ground.
Only about half of his soybean fields are growing a crop. The rest are filled with dead beans, decaying beans, or are simply too wet to plant. Plunge has tried, even though he knows working wet ground is bad for the topsoil.
When you go home at night, you don't feel like you did anything right that day. You just feel like you went out and absolutely slopped it in.
That's a feeling farmers like Plunge might have to get used to, because this season's storms are not a fluke. They're one consequence of a century-long pattern in which the Midwest has gotten 2 degrees warmer.
Kind of what we would expect.
Jim Angel is the Illinois state climatologist.
As you warm the Earth's atmosphere, it kind of revs up the water cycle as well, so you tend to get more humidity, more fuel for passing thunderstorms.
Today, the Midwest gets 10% to 15% more precipitation than a century ago. Angel says records for more recent decades show that storms are also becoming more intense, unleashing high winds and hail and dumping several inches of rain at once, which can be a nightmare for farming.
You get a lot of soil erosion, you can get a lot of nutrients flushed downstream, and you can have damage to crops.
The big storms are giving farmers less time to plant their crop, as every extra inch of rain keeps them off their fields for at least 2.5 days. But it's not all bad news. The Midwest's changing climate does have some benefits. Eugene Tockley co-authored the most recent National Climate Assessment's chapter on agriculture. He says more rain allows the soil to stockpile water, giving plants something to drink when things dry up later in the summer. Plus, warmer temperatures have farmers reaping the rewards of plumper corn and bulkier soybeans.
It's allowed them to plant earlier, and they harvest it later. And so the longer growing season generally means they can convert more atmospheric carbon dioxide into plant carbon and to grain, and so yields have gone up.
For now. With temperatures likely to be even hotter by mid-century, scientists predict yields to plateau in the core of the Corn Belt. And the western and southern parts, like Kansas and the bottom half of Missouri, they could get too hot to grow corn at all.
There are regions that are going to experience a transformation of agriculture. And that is, you have to do something totally different, and it may be going back to grazing land as it was originally.
Back on his muddy farm in Missouri, Matt Plunge is coming to terms with the more immediate heartbreak of having to let a large chunk of his land go fallow.
So I know there's some acres we won't get planted now at all. I've already scratched them off the list, but, you know, that just cuts into our pocket and our bottom line.
If he survives this year's economic blow, the science suggests his land will be able to continue growing corn and soybeans, at least for many decades. Abby Wendell, Harvest Public Media.
Another story from Harvest coming up about protecting and researching solitary bees. We hear about farm to table so often these days, but there's a step in the middle there that gets overlooked. It's the unsavory part of being a meat eater, the part many of us would rather not think about, the slaughtering and processing of the animals. As farmer Dave Fisher tells it, his partnership with a small processor near his farm is one of the most important business relationships he has. Working with Sander Processing has allowed him to completely change his business model.
So we've really kind of grown up together as they've kind of expanded and added more people. We were able to grow with them.
Their partnership has grown such that 2 years ago, Sander built an addition to their facility just to process Fisher's orders.
What they do for us is basically do all the slaughtering, all the processing. So when I say processing, it's, you know, cutting the steaks, grinding the burger, grinding the sausages and so forth, making the patties, and doing the packaging for us.
Fisher Farms is a 750-acre area that's home to 900 animals near Jasper, Indiana. The farm has been in his family since 1868. Fisher raises his cattle without hormones or antibiotics. He's been selling his meat directly to restaurants since 2004, which also happened to be the year after Sander opened a new facility nearby. Before that, Fisher used to sell his animals to companies like Tyson.
And we felt like we had really good quality meat, and we just didn't feel like we were getting the premium for that. So basically when I would ask Tyson and say, okay, I'm going to be raising these cattle, and a year from now I'm going to have more for sale of these high-quality natural calves, can you give me a premium for those? And, you know, they will not commit to a premium into the future, and also everything is dependent upon the commodity cattle market. So I just didn't want to have my family's livelihood based on what the commodity market was going to be next year.
He also points out a key detail of working with a company like Tyson. They buy the animal, not the meat.
Once I load them on a truck and they are gone, I never worry about the meat again. I get a check for that live animal. With using Sander processing, I'm able to retain ownership of the meat and then sell it to the restaurants, sell it to whoever I want.
So now he needed customers. Back in the early 2000s, he would just show up at restaurants around southern Indiana to pitch his products.
And usually I'd drag one of my kids along, and we would go knocking door to door on the different restaurants.
One of the doors he knocked on was Nick's English Hut. Greg Rago answered the door.
Everybody calls you Rags. My title is I'm a managing partner, owner of Nick's English Hut. It's kind of an interesting story that Dave and I met. We always bought our meat from Ferris Market. We bought beef there for years. Dave came by as a cold call, just walking from restaurant to restaurant, wanted to know if I wanted to buy his beef. And I said, well, Dave, I really appreciate what you're doing. I'd never met him before, but a super nice guy. And I said, Dave, I've been buying meat. We've been buying meat here for 60 years from the Ferris Market. I really just can't stop buying from him. He understood, but we kind of had, we always kept in contact. And then literally overnight, several months later, Ferris Market went out of business, which we had no clue that was going to happen. So scrambling around, my wife and I was trying to figure out what to do. And so light bulb came on. Let's call Dave Fisher. And Dave said, sure, I'll work with you. We'll do the best. They'll do the best they can. And the rest is history. So I guess we're proud to say we're probably one of his first big customers, and we're very happy with it.
Now they collaborate on the Nick's Burger, a special blend developed by Fisher and Sander Processing just for Rags' restaurant. They also offer Fisher steaks on their menu. They use their beef and pork for their chili, ground turkey for their turkey burgers, brisket and pork loin. All this totals up to 500, 600 pounds of meat per week. I caught up with Rags after the lunch rush.
Well, it's kind of, I think, what all of us really want to do when you have an independent, smaller restaurant, even our restaurant seats 400 people, where you can trust the person that is raising your beef and processing your beef.
And as a chef, he says it keeps him creative. The way it works from Fisher's end is chefs call him up or text him on Mondays to place their orders. Then he sends that order sheet to Sander Processing, which receives the animals and then prepares all the ribeyes and sausages. Deliver the orders to the restaurants, and that meat will probably get to customers' plates by that same Friday. The challenge Fisher faces is selling all parts of the animal.
You know, I've got so much ribeye, so much filet, so much strip steak, so much sirloin, and so forth each week, and I've got to figure out which restaurants those are going to.
Which is what makes his relationship with Rags and Nick's English Hut so special.
You know, I'll call him up and say, you know, I am just swimming in sirloin. Can you put a sirloin on your menu? And they've been super to do that.
So week in and week out, Nick's might change their specials based on what extra cuts they get from Fisher. Since Nick's tries to keep its food under $20 a plate, it's the customers who might benefit the most from this setup.
What I've been seeing is that our high-end steaks are generally in high-end restaurants where it's $40 and $50 a plate. But our burgers are higher than the conventional market, but if Rags might want to add 50 cents, To make it cost okay for him for a burger, I think a lot of people are willing to pay an extra 50 cents.
That's one Fisher product you're absolutely guaranteed to see on Nick's menu every single day. The burger is definitely one of their best sellers.
It's a 80% protein, 20% fat blend. Their fat is very natural. It's got like a buttery type flavor. Their meat has an excellent grain to it. Any steak that you have has great marbling, which means it's a great combination of fat and protein together, which gives it a very unique flavor also.
A unique burger, fitting for a unique partnership. We've got more with Dave Fisher and Greg Rago at eartheats.org. Coming up, Chef Arlen Llewellyn.
Okay, so the coleslaw benefits from a little bit of time. It's nice and bright and fresh right now, but also if you let it sit a little bit longer, those flavors are going to start melding together and the cabbage will get a little bit more tender.
Veggie tacos, people. Great recipes in the second half for cooks who like to work ahead.
You can have the fourth position on my list. Must admit your kisses would be missed. But how in the world could I exist without tacos, enchiladas, and beans?
Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, locally grown since 1976, offering bushels of locally sourced products throughout all its locations. Bloomingfoods.coop. Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats. Annie Corrigan here with you.
We are in the very tiny kitchen of Function Brewing, which is the pipe dream of my husband Steve and myself.
Arlen Llewellyn is the chef at this Bloomington brewery. Steve makes the beer. We've got a couple recipes with Arlen today. These are components for tacos, no meat tacos.
I was vegetarian for several years, and I don't think there's that many people that are wanting to eat meat substitutes on a daily basis, just because they are a little bit more processed in many cases. So just try to focus on whole foods that can feel really substantial and satisfying in a meatless entree.
Like eggplant that she bought from Raber's Family Farm.
Which you'll notice that I'm peeling because a lot of people are not too fond of eggplant because of the bitterness that that peel can bring. And I think when you remove that from the equation, you're just getting this meaty substance, but pretty neutral flavor. And this chipotle marinade will be bringing a lot of flavor to the party. So the eggplant's primary role is purely texture. So we are going to go ahead and cut these up into slices.
Long slices to save you time flipping them on the grill.
You're almost done with that.
Then for the marinade, several cloves of garlic.
Red wine vinegar. Chili powder.
Some sugar and oregano.
Chipotles and adobo. Sorry, I'm going to turn this up. We're going to go ahead and put the eggplant slices in the marinade.
A resealable plastic bag is good for this.
Obviously push out the air and just really let that marinade seep between the slices. And as I said, 1 to 2 days. If you're my type of cook, it works really well to do something like this, so you can get it all ready. And then when your guests show up, you're really just throwing the eggplant on the grill and assembling the tacos. The coleslaw will already have been made in advance because both of these components are going to do better the longer they can sit.
That coleslaw, that's what's next. More with Arlen Llewellyn in her kitchen at Function Brewing in a bit. Bees and other pollinators need lots of flowers and grasses. Across the Midwest, the habitat is shrinking. That has left many native bees without food and without a home. For Harvest Public Media, Abigail Wilson has a story of researchers trying to change that.
A patchwork of bamboo and paper tubes with diameters no bigger than a nickel are stacked artfully inside a 4x4 wooden frame near the edge of a public hiking trail in Lawrence, Kansas. Welcome to a bee hotel.
Are we allowed to get closer?
Might get stuck.
No, let's go. Look. Just watch the flag.
The Bee Hotel is set in a 3,000-acre plot of land put aside for scientific research and education at the University of Kansas.
Honeybees and bumblebees will not be nesting in a bee hotel. You won't find them nesting there because that's not part of their life history.
And Daphne Mays is a PhD student at KU. She studies wild bees. She says that while honeybees are important pollinators, so are other bee species native to the Midwest.
And what you will be finding are things like leafcutter bees, and as the name is describing it, they cut pieces of leaves to line their nests.
The nests are usually made in stems of plants or hollowed out logs. Each nest has repeating segments of nesting material, larvae, and pollen. Once it's full, the bee seals it off and moves on to another location. As more ground gets plowed under or paved over, bee hotels can ensure that bees have a place to live.
I think that there is a lot of research going on right now focusing on native bees, and so I think that over time we'll have a much better understanding of these native species, of their needs, and how much they fluctuate.
And while statistics on solitary wild bee populations over time are hard to pin down, the decreasing numbers of other pollinators are not. The number of monarch butterflies wintering in Mexico is down by 90%. Last year, a federal survey found that beekeepers lost more than 40% of their colonies. If there's anyone who understands bees, it's this man.
Hi, I'm Abigail. It's nice to meet you. Thanks for letting me come to your home.
Entomologist Dr. Charles Michener. At age 96, he's been studying bees for more than 80 years. He wrote the book on bees, a more than 900-page work called Bees of the World.
This was published in 2000. And then there's another edition of it. This is the first edition.
He says that insecticides, especially a variety called neonicotinoids, are the most common cause for the decline in both native bees and honeybees. That spells trouble in the Corn Belt.
Of course, there are other things like destruction of natural vegetation. And when somebody destroys it, plows it up and plants it in soybeans or something else like that, then the bees are left without their ordinary sources of food.
Bees are crucial to growing millions of dollars worth of crops, and some native bee species, like those at the Bee Hotel, are solely responsible for pollinating a particular plant.
We wouldn't have alfalfa for animal food. Fruits like almonds, apples, etc., we wouldn't have. They just wouldn't exist. Other things we might still have, but in much less abundance than we have them now.
If there's one thing researchers want to hammer home, it's that native pollinators should not be taken for granted. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Abigail Wilson.
Abigail Wilson is a reporter for KMUW in Wichita. Harvest is a reporter collective based in the Midwest. Follow their blog at harvestpublicmedia.org. Arlen Llewellyn and her husband Steve opened Function Brewing a year and a half ago. She cooks, he brews. Arlen has no formal training. Instead, when they started planning the business 4 years ago, she took jobs in various restaurants around town to learn the ropes.
Well, I was pretty obsessed with food. It was really the only thing that I'd ever really connected with. And I had gotten to a point where I was really burnt out of my career in human resources and wanted to do something that would just sort of follow that passion and fill me with bliss on a daily basis.
She considers her kitchen a teaching space. Many of her employees are new to cooking, and they're there to learn how a restaurant works. She can relate to that. That's also part of why they work primarily in weight in their recipes. It's a way to standardize the dishes for their 8 to 10 cooks. This is also key because they're working with lots of unusually sized veggies, as Arlen will explain. So for this coleslaw recipe, it's 1 1/3 pounds of cabbage. But first, the sauce.
We're going to make a creamy cilantro lime dressing. Garlic, lime juice. These scallions from Living Roots are so huge. Like, I would say that one of these is probably equivalent to 3 supermarket scallions. So that's the thing about working with local produce, is it is a little bit different, which is a really beautiful thing, because large-scale vegetable production is so standardized that it looks the same, it tastes the same, and when you're buying it from the farmer down the street, that's not the case. And then some buttermilk and some sour cream. So you just want to start these things off at low and then increase the speed. And we get that nice green color. We're just going to chop up some cabbage to toss with it. So this is also some Raber family produce cabbage, which we are going to be slicing up. I think it's good to think about the size of the cabbage slice based on the amount of time you have for it to sit. So if you're going to be serving this within just a couple hours, you want to make sure you get that cabbage really fine. If you have several days, then you're going to want to start with bigger cabbage, because just like that chipotle marinade, it will start acting on the vegetable and breaking it down. You're trying to get that perfect window where still some crunch, but also a true, like, infiltration of the flavor into every bite.
The fresh stuff that she just made is very bright in flavor. The slaw that sat for a couple days is more subdued, but it's also a bit more complex. Arlen decided to construct some tacos with a little bit of each.
Just gonna load these up.
Starting with hard shells, then it's the grilled eggplant, followed by the slaw, and topped with some jack cheese. Now, Steve Llewellyn has a different philosophy on taco construction.
He would definitely say that the cheese belongs down here at the bottom, but I like getting that cheese last, so I'm going to put it on top.
Leave it to the beer guy.
Yeah, he thinks that it's because the meat, or in this case the eggplant, hot, the heat of that will melt the cheese on the bottom. I totally agree with that, but I've just had so many tacos of my youth that started with cheese on the top that I feel very committed to that. These are going to be messy.
That could be like a tagline for the restaurant.
It's true, yeah.
This is going to be messy.
Maybe we should get function-branded bibs. It'll just say, these are going to be messy.
Chef Arlen Llewellyn of Function Brewing. That was fun. These recipes are at eartheats.org.
You've only got 3 competitors, tacos. From the Mississippi.
Production support for Earth Eats comes from Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And Blooming Foods, locally grown since 1976, offering bushels of locally sourced products throughout all its locations. BloomingFoods.coop. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Thanks, everybody. Appreciate the company today. I'm Annie Corrigan.